I rode with old Jeb Stuart and his band of Southern whores. There never were no Yankees who could beat us force to force. No, they never did defeat us, but we never could evade their dirty foreign politics and cowardly blockade. Well, we hadn't any powder and we hadn't any shot. We hadn't any money to buy what we ain't got. So we rode our worn out horses and we ate on plain corn meal. And we licked them where we caught them with Southern guts and steel. Well, we sunk the ship at Sumter and we broke her plumb in two. And we showed them bully Yankees just what we aim to do. At a little creek called Bull Run, we took their starry rag to wipe our horses down with, and I ain't here to brag. Well, there aren't as many left of us as rode out at the start. And then there are the weary, weak, and body sad of heart. We fought a fight to tell about, and I am here to say I'd climb my horse and follow Marsh to hell come any day.
Amen. Sing it, Raylan. Here we are at the Rebel Madman radio show here on Republic Broadcasting Network on the fourth day of November in the year of 2023. And we have quite a program for you today, folks. I'm glad that you were able to tune in. But first of all, let's get some things out of the way. We need to get some support out there for RBN. RBN is one of the last bastions out there that provides for freedom of speech. There are a few others, but RBN is out there fighting the hard fight. And they need your support wherever it can be and in whatever amount you could afford. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and check on that. And there's a donate button there, or you can mail in a donation, or you can call the station and help them out the best you possibly can. Well, with all of that being said, now we're going to jump into a great program here. And I have with me a lady it was my great pleasure to meet a couple of weeks ago. And her story is just intriguing to a great extent. And I tell you what, I thought about doing kind of a lead-on bio for her, but I think she could do it much better than I do. She's much more familiar with the facts. Right, Stephanie?
I sure am. Thank you for having me on.
All right, Stephanie, tell the folks about yourself, would you please?
Sure. So my name is Stephanie Anson. I'm a Navy veteran. I had joined the United States Navy in 1995. And, of course, I come from a long line of military members, you know, starting with, you know, my grandfather, aunts, uncles that I've all served. And so for us, you know, going in, you know, at 18, it was a great pride for me to be able to join the service and serve the country. And, you know, I was facing some things at the time, too, to where you know, they're just, I didn't think at the time there was a lot there out, you know, out there for me. And like most individuals, when they're very young, they, you know, assume that the world's at their feet and they're going to take, you know, the bull by the horns and march on. And so I was very strong-willed. And when I had joined, my uncle was a command master chief over the Naval Hospital in Camp Lejeune. And he had warned me not to go to the MEP station on my own. And of course, being 18 and strong-willed like I was, I decided that the first thing I was going to do when he took a deployment out to Hawaii was to go ahead and march down there and join the service. And so he gets back and he says to me, what in the world did you do? I asked you not to go, and there's very good reasons why. And so when I had initially joined, I had wanted to go in under Nuke. And of course, you know, he quickly changed my mind on that. And then I ended up going in initially as, you know, an electronics technician. And of course, that ended up going into, when all things are said, I ended up being in IT, so information technology. And I was stationed at the Joint Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia. And the Staff College was under the National Defense University. and responsible for wartime, strategic wartime training, and, you know, bringing through officers for various branches, including, you know, foreign allies. And they would also hold dignitaries there, different conferences, you know, of individuals coming through. And my sole responsibility was to work on the dot mil network, in addition to any of the training parameters that were needed for the warfare training that the officers would tend, you know, in addition to some GCCS protocols, you know, in-house for simulation. So there was a lot of very interesting access that I had, and I absolutely loved everything that I did. And when I initially joined, you know, I was very fit. I was working out probably about 3 hours a day prior to joining the service. And, you know, I mean, I just was exactly what you would expect a service member to look like, you know, as far as fitness training goes. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people that have served in the armed forces remember, especially back then, that we'd all line up and get those shots in those pressurized guns that carried multiple shots in them. And, you know, I remember watching people fall out and, you know, take those shots, and not everybody can handle needles very well. So, you know, we go through those trials, and within 48 hours, I became severely ill, and there was no explanation for it. So they, you know, hauled me off. I had some testing done into the hospital. I was put on light duty. Mind you, I'm in boot camp. And so now I'm concerned, you know, that, you know, I might have come down with something that, you know, caused me to have to leave the service. But that didn't happen. After a short period of time, it subsided. The symptoms subsided slightly. And when I got to my duty station, they flared back up again. And so then I ended up going in and out of the Portsmouth Naval Hospital, and I was going through all kinds of treatments. And at the time, they had classified it as a new disease. And what I found out is that this disease actually had started becoming prominent in the 1980s, the late 1980s, but really focus in on studying it didn't take place until, you know, the early 90s. And so with this new disease, so to speak, I was sitting in groups of other military service members that were dealing with CFS, ALS, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome. And all of it seemed to be interrelated, but nobody could put their finger on what was going on and what the, you know, what the issue was, what caused all of us to come down with this, and, you know, what were all these symptoms that we were going through. So after a little while, I was in and out of internal medicine, and you know, my symptoms had subsided for a period of time. And then, so I was kind of going through these periods where I was very ill, and then I was, you know, it felt like I was in recovery. And so I just kept thinking, you know, maybe I just keep catching, you know, all these different illnesses, you know, what's going on. And there wasn't a lot of focus on autoimmune issues at the time. There was not a lot of focus on, you know, really anything with gut health or, you know, memory loss, you know, those things. So it seemed to be kind of all new for all, you know, and going through all of these studies. And, you know, and sometimes I would get really bad where just holding a glass of water felt like it was 10 pounds, you know. And, you know, and being at light duty and where I was stationed was a blessing, you know, with going through some of these things. But, you know, I was actually authorized, you know, if I passed out at my desk, I was authorized to be there and to be left alone, which is really odd. And I've found it odd at the time, especially where I was stationed, you know, because most of the individuals that I was around were special forces. You know, you have a lot of top tier colonels, admirals, and individuals coming through here, you know, where these individuals, the weight that far surpassed anything that I was dealing with as far as being sick, as in my mind that I felt as to where, you know, I could get such a consideration for a light duty station. So I thought it was odd. I thought the treatment throughout the entire process of training, of being stationed there was pretty odd when I was going in for all the medical treatment, because it really felt I was a guinea pig. I was being poked, prodded, going in for MRIs. They were taking all kinds of vials of blood for me. I had to, you know, attend these group meetings. and go through all of this different exploratory medicines in addition to, you know, testing. And, you know, fatigue was one of the largest things that I helped, you know, I had, in addition to some of my organs had enlarged. And so there's various things that I was going through. And, you know, I started to suspect personally that it had a lot to do with the vaccinations. And I didn't have any proof of that. But one of the gentlemen that I was stationed with was a colonel that his entire command was over there during Gulf War. And they were suffering from Gulf War syndrome. And this colonel, actually, Colonel Davis, he was responsible for testifying in front of Congress, you know, about what was going on with our members coming back from Gulf War syndrome. And so we used to sit quite often and kind of talk about it and converse, you know, with what he was seeing personally with his men. And what was very odd is that the men weren't just sick, but their children and their wives were getting sick as well. And, you know, I remember having these conversations. So as I'm going through, you know, speaking with him and everything that he's doing, you know, he was suffering greatly. So he would go ahead and attend, you know, this hearing and provide the information. And he basically told, you know, them in Congress that, you know, we're not guinea pigs. And he requested that they stop being treated like guinea pigs and be left alone. And so right after that time period is when anthrax happened. And I don't know if, you know, a lot of people remember that was kind of a big deal because it was the first time that we saw soldiers starting to refuse the vaccination. And I thought that was very interesting because still in my heart of hearts, I felt the issues that I was going through were completely related to the vaccinations. But again, I had no proof. It was just, I mean, it just made sense to me. And I felt that that's what, you know, I was suffering from. So I started researching individuals that were receiving, and of course they were processing, you know, members out of the military who were outright refusing. You had individuals that were being court-martialed, and then you had individuals that did take the anthrax shot that were 100% disability. And, you know, and so I was just shy of my end of obligated service at that time when it happened. And I remember, you know, being so close to getting out, you know, I wasn't going to take the shot. And so after that took place, 9/11 happened. And so all of that research that I was looking into kind of went to, you know, went to the side. And because what I found through Gulf War syndrome research is that, you know, some of those issues that individuals were suffering from, they were, you know, stating that, hey, it was probably from the chemicals that were, you know, taking place over there. They were spraying, you know, non-lethal biological weapons that, you know, Iraq had had. And so some of those symptoms that the individuals were, or the members were coming back with were mimicking what I was personally going through. And so a lot of it, you know, just, I just thought was just very strange. You know, and it's a common joke in the military. They always say that, you know, you're government owned. And so when that takes place, you know, what's going through your mind is that you're a guinea pig. And they do try, you know, different medications on you, and you will go through different testing, which I personally experienced. And then on top of that, it always rang, you know, true to me in my mind of listening to Colonel Davis speak and, you know, basically tell, you know, Congress that they need to stop testing on our military members this way. So time had gone on, and I was in a recovery period, you know, for a good amount of time, and I started having issues with my motor skills. I started having memory loss where I would lose entire time periods of my childhood, time periods with my own daughter, you know, in addition to things that were most recent events. And even when someone would repeat the story of what I did, what was going on, and that I was there, I still couldn't even, which was really embarrassing. I'm young, you know, at the time, and I'm thinking to myself, this should not be happening. And so then those mild symptoms, you know, were coming and going. And then after my 30s, I started getting really, really sick. And at one point, it got so bad that I pretty much was off my feet for about 5 years. And I had my third son, and my husband said to me, he said, you know, we do pretty good for ourselves. Why don't you stay home and really focus on your health? You've never had an opportunity, you know, to raise any of the children at home, you know, and be a stay-at-home mom. So why don't you go ahead and do that? And I was at a point where I was basically in the fetal position for, you know, weeks at a time, not able to walk, not able to eat, couldn't figure out. I was in and out of doctor's offices. No doctor would sit down and listen to me. All they wanted to do was write a script, which would anger me because I knew and I understood at the time what was, you know, taking place with all the changes of Obamacare and the changes in the healthcare payments, how they were getting paid with the ICD-9 code changes to ICD-10. You know, doctors had could only see patients 15 minutes at a time in order to, you know, to keep their revenue up. And I understood that from working on the opposite side with, you know, healthcare and nutraceuticals and trying to provide when all these changes were going on, doctors were being absorbed into, you know, the hospitals or they were going into these large doctor groups because the revenue streams for them were not covering the cost of care. And that was, you know, for insurance purposes. And so they were pulling out loans to pay their staff. This is where you start seeing now, especially in the last decade, where you'll see a lot of product being carried in doctors' offices where they do Botox. You see dentists doing Botox. They're selling product that are, you know, doctor labeled out of their offices. And that's because they have to generate revenue. And if they don't generate revenue on their own, then they get absorbed into these doctors' groups or these hospitals where everything becomes policy. And that started to break our doctor-patient relationships, where you started seeing a real huge push on prescriptions, not having the ability to meet with the doctor more than one time. Most of the symptoms I go in for, you know, the doctors would tell me, I can only deal with one. We don't have enough time. You'll have to book another appointment. So I found myself firing doctor after doctor after doctor. I would never get any of the scripts filled. Not a single doctor was in agreement with what was going on with me. They kept sending me in for exploratory surgeries and, you know, with my diagnosis and, you know, I just knew that there was another way. So I ended up going in a holistic path to try and figure out, you know, how to heal my body. So in 2018, my husband's, the company, the franchise that he works with, they sponsor New Year's Eve, where they used to, and that was before COVID, in New York City. And so he had a major award that he had won, and we had turned down going up there quite a few times just because we had some concerns about being in the larger cities. We just didn't want to be there, especially during these time periods throughout the year where there could be a hot focal point with, you know, certain things happening. Of course, you see a lot of that out there. And my background with what I've seen and understand as far as, you know, what our government does going in to create war or break up other governments, I recognized a long time ago that those things were happening in our own country. So that just made me very hesitant to travel, especially in the last 10 years. And but we decided to go ahead and go. And while I was there, I started, you know, going real heavy into that research again because I was done being so ill. And I came across a microbiologist who was also representative, you know, with the House and Senate, and he sat on several committees, you know, overseeing what was taking place with the Gulf War syndrome and taking a look at, you know, vaccinations. He is the founder and chief scientist of a microbiology lab, the Institute of Microbiology. And his main study was taking a look at emerging infections. And what he realized is that there was a broad category of non-lethal biological warfare agents that were classified by the military that he was finding were the number one issue in most of these veterans and active duty military that were dealing with CFS, ALS, MS, and fibromyalgia. And what he realized is that there was a strain, a line of mycoplasma. And mycoplasma, for anyone that doesn't know, it's a genus of bacteria that lacks a cell wall. And what he realized is that this mycoplasma was being weaponized. And once he found that it was sitting, existing as a non-lethal biological warfare agent with the U.S. military, is when he decided that he was going to start researching a little bit harder. And what happened was that his daughter came back from the Gulf War, and she was very sick, and she also had the Gulf War syndrome. And at the same time that was going on, he also realized that there were a bunch of prisoners and prison guards in a Texas prison that were coming down with some of these strange diseases, mimicking the same thing with ALS, MS, fibromyalgia, and CFS. And so he started doing studies into it, and he requested, based upon his credentials, he had requested that he could oversee these autopsies or have the data from the autopsies. And the bodies were ended up being collected, and private autopsies were being done on an army base, and their bodies were being cremated. And of course, that data was never provided to him. So, and since he was a leading authority on the Gulf War syndrome, and he was pretty upset for it. So he started putting two and two together. And so he was appointed the chairman of the medical scientific panel for the Persian Gulf War Veterans Conference. And based upon the suspicion of the bacterium that caused these diseases, and he believed that this was a product of biological warfare, and that our military members and individuals in the United States, the public specifically, were being tested. And so he served as this authority on the United States House of Representatives. And so the study, he was studying those connections, and basically he had a first line into it, especially since his daughter, was suffering from it. So, in general, there's over 200 mycoplasmas that exist, and most of the time people's autoimmune systems can deal with it and can fight it off. But he found that a particular mycoplasma called Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus was present in 100% of the Gulf War syndrome veterans. And he additionally discovered that it was infecting the spouses. And it took me right back to the same story that Colonel Davis was, talking to me about when it came to what was happening to his men and their families. And so then, in addition to that, Gerald Schumacher, who was a special forces colonel who was in charge of biological weapons detection, blew the whistle after he retired, basically admitting to, this being alive and well. And so a little bit of time goes on, and in 2021, COVID hits. And the first thing that I'm thinking of when these vaccinations come out is that I want to have absolutely nothing to do with them. And I started doing research very quickly into what was going on. And I understood from time periods before, if you followed going on in the background, a lot of the involvement our government was in, most of us that understood, what they were capable of doing and what they have done in the past, even in our own country, we were worried that the biological warfare weapon was going to be smallpox. We didn't think that it was going to be something on this nature. And so the first thing that we were thinking of was these vaccines were probably going to be infected with smallpox or some other kind of biological agent that was going to affect everybody. So I'm by chance listening to, I turn on an interview, and there's Dr. Mikovits. And she states in this interview that while she was working alongside of Fauci, that one in four service members were infected with a contaminated vaccine that had a bioweapon in it. And other than having an idea of what Dr. Nicholson had found and through his studies, and then what the whistleblower, the retired colonel, had provided, there was no other associations that really solidified, what was going on with me and why most of these individuals that I was seeing that I knew, especially, the special forces members, were suffering so bad that there had to be a connection there. And that was it. And she stated that during her tenure, working alongside of Fauci, that the biological agents and the mycoplasmas were, in fact, on purpose in these vaccines that were given to the military members to see how we were, react to them. And so we basically were test subjects and study patients. And so from that point on, I found out that she was going to come to Tampa for a conference. And there was a doctor that I had met where I currently live, Because mind you, as I'm the 26 years that I'm dealing with this, you know, I know much more about all of this than most doctors I talk to. And the problem with that is when they start, you know, just starting to write off scripts very quickly or telling me they don't have a lot of time or they don't understand what I'm talking about, or they start arguing with me over, you know, possible scenarios I'm speaking to them about, then, you know, I fire them. I just, you know, it's one of those things where I've just come to realize we've had a very controlled environment when it comes to medicine. And at that point, you know, COVID is alive and well, or what they call COVID, you know, going through, and I was not going to mask. I absolutely refused to mask, and I refused a lot of things that were going on. And I walk into the doctor's office, and my test was, if they make me put a mask on, I'm leaving. And so I walk in and I sit down and I'm waiting for him to come out to call me back. And he comes out and he looks at me and he's not wearing a mask. And he says, thank bleep bleep. And then says, come on back. And at that point, we sat down probably for about 3.5 hours and started really conversing about what we thought was really going on. I found out that he was a doctor in the Army previously, and a lot of the credentials that, you know, he carried. And he was one of the first doctors I have ever met, one, that had a suspicion something wasn't right, and two, that actually took his time to sit down and really listen to me and understand what was going on. And at that point, you know, he went on to research a lot of what Dr. Mikovits had found. And, you know, so I found out, as I said earlier, that she was going to be in Tampa. And so I requested that he come along with me. So I had taken my father, my son, and it was a 3-day conference. There was a lot of medical doctors there. Everybody was wondering what was going on, you know, with these vaccinations coming out. And this conference really focused on it, especially because the rollout happened, you know, in Europe and in other countries before, you know, came to the United States. And there was a lot of impact that was taking place with individuals. And that's really what this focused on. And so my sole purpose of going was to meet Dr. Mikovits. So I had actually designed a shirt because I wanted her to really see that I was there. My goal was to speak to her. Especially after, you know, listening to what she had to say, and I really wanted additional validation. And at this time, I'm simmering. I'm very angry, you know, especially when you go into the service with the mindset that I had, and I was willingly wanting to give my life over for my country if that was what was needed of me, to find out that we are their guinea pigs and at their discretion as far as, you know, what they're doing to us. And so, you know, I was very angry, and I was standing in line, and I had the doc with me, and her assistant looked back and saw, you know, what my shirt had said. And basically I had a shirt that made that said, Dr. Mikovits, U.S. Navy veteran, I'm 1 in 4. And that goes back to her statement of that, you know, what she made when she was, you know, doing that interview. And so she looked at me, they cleared the whole line and they pulled me forward, and, you know, they told me I had as long as I wanted to talk to her. And the moment I got to her, I started crying. She started crying. You know, we gave each other a big hug. I mean, it was just the validation of alone of knowing, you know, that I've known for so long that I suspected it was our own government that was responsible for it. Really kind of hit home. And and she did person that, you know, Fauci had everything to do with the weaponized vaccines. And so in, I think it was 2014 timeframe, you know, there was it was after 2014, because what stopped it was the election in progress. So they had released information. I don't remember what where it came through, but it was a military release basically warning, you know, military members and veterans to stay away from the DNA testing sites, you know, like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, and that there was a biological agent component that was going to be associated to it. So do not give your DNA over to these entities. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is pretty, you know, pretty important. And hey, so
Stephanie,
that just... Yes.
Stephanie, please, we've got a commercial break coming up here very quickly, and there's the music. And can you hold on, and we'll get back to it on the flip side?
You got it.
All right. Thank you. Support RBN, folks.
handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee that's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Charles de Gaulle once said, actually, it's difficult to envision in this regard any other criterion, any other standard than gold. Yes, gold, which does not change in nature, which can be made into either bars, ingots, or coins, which has no nationality, and which is considered in all places and all times the immutable and fiduciary value par excellence. So when the question is, why gold? It's simple, my friends. The answer to that question is simply, why not? Like it or not, precious metals will always be the world's reserve currency. Even though nations do not define their currency by their worth in, say, gold, individuals still buy gold and silver to protect themselves from inflation. The more money a nation's central bank pours into the economy, the less valuable its currency, the dollar is, which means the price of everything else rises. $21 up for a bag of dog food. Seeing that the dollar is cheap, that's why the cost of everything goes up. It's because the buying power, the value of the dollar, has tanked. It's worth nothing. And yet gold that your family would have owned in 1907 will buy at least the same amount of goods, if not far more. William McPhee once stated, it's extraordinary how many emotional storms one may weather in safety if one is ballasted with ever so little gold. The truth about money, gold versus cash in a crisis, gold a valuable thing to store, the power of gold in times of crisis. Historical sketch of paper currency. Oh, and beware the ides of rare coin dealers. And Alan Greenspan's speech on gold and economic freedom. How interesting. I'm going to give you gold and silver in 5 easy lessons. Seeking out the most efficient and most secure route to owning gold and converting it into widely accepted currency is the next best thing to enjoying gold-backed currency, my friends. In a world of central bankers hell-bent on devaluing our savings, you need to own private gold standard. Contact me, Jeffrey Bennett at Kettle Moraine Limited, by calling our phone number at 602-799-8214. That's 602-799-8214.
Matt, man, and nothing probably hurts me any more than to interrupt Skynyrd and Freebird. Such a classic song. But anyway, first thing I've got to do here, folks, before we get moving on, is I've got a confession to make. And that is, in my previous conversation with Miss Stephanie Anson, I was under the assumption, and it's all on me, wasn't on her, she didn't say it. But I was under the assumption that her medical issues transpired with the COVID vaccine. And from her testimony just now, I was wrong.
People ask me all the time, Chris, if you could only take one supplement for the rest of your life, which one would it be? The answer is easy. Redwood. You see, Redwood is a powerful...
How'd that happen?
Sorry about that, Mike.
stupid YouTube that plays automatically.
Okay, buddy. Well, anyway, that happens, Jim. So, yes, the assumption was on my part. Stephanie is being totally accurate, and that is the one thing I wanted to make sure, that the mistake was mine. And Stephanie, I've got several folks who are saying that they're just loving what you're doing, so do it some more.
Okay, absolutely. So I think where I left off was meeting Dr. Megabits and speaking with her,
Yes, ma'am.
With regards to what took place. So yes, that whole purpose of going to that 3-day conference was not just to learn about what was going on with the COVID vaccine and what I could do to inform others, but it was also to really get that confirmation from her and have a one-on-one conversation and hear it from the horse's mouth, not just in an interview, have the ability to ask her questions, and grieve a little bit, I guess, in a way. It was a huge release for me that gave me the ability to kind of move on, to focus really on my health, because what I also found out with mycoplasmas, and since Dr. Garth Nicholson also taught med school at one of the universities in Texas, he had stated most of the modern doctors today, they don't even teach them about mycoplasmas anymore, where it was very prevalent in the 80s and prior, that they don't even know anything about them. And so if a patient were to come in and just try to get assistance and even talk to them about mycoplasma, they really wouldn't understand. And, and I kind of had my own run-in on that, because I had a complication that came up when I had gotten very ill that time back in 2012, that I was going through, when I was going through doctor after doctor after doctor, I had pulled a tick off the back of my leg, and so I started getting some other complications, and immediately I was fearful. I said, I already have a compromised immune system. I live in deer tick territory. We are on, 20 acres. There's deer all over our property. It's the famous tick, that you pull off with the star. And I said, oh, geez, I'm hoping that I'm not going to get something associated to it, because some of the bacterium and what they find mycoplasma in ticks as well. And so that was very interesting. And of course, I was very ill again within 48 hours of pulling that tick off, but it was for another reason. And so I don't know why, but out of nowhere, I'm obviously a meat eater. And I started, what ended up happening and finding the tick. Let me back up a little bit. My son's school, his elementary school, was having a fundraiser. And that fundraiser was ribs. They were selling ribs from one of the local barbecues. They were really well known. It was a great deal. So we had stopped by after school to pick some up. And then we ate. And probably about 2 hours later is when I saw the tick on the back of my leg and had pulled it off. Well, later that evening, my head blew up like a balloon. My ears were extremely hot. My neck was swollen. My face was swollen. And I was having a reaction, allergic reaction, and I had no idea to what it could have been. And so I assumed, well, maybe there's something wrong with the meat, or they used something. I don't have any allergies that I'm aware of, food allergies. So it was very interesting and strange to go through. Well, it never went away. About 6 weeks in, I had told my husband, I said, I can't do this anymore. I don't know what's causing why I'm having allergic reactions almost on a daily basis. So I finally decided to do an elimination diet. And at the same time, as I'm doing the elimination diet, I'm doing research, and I find a medical journal article that's talking about the alpha-gal syndrome. And that alpha gal is an enzyme that's carried by these deer ticks, the Lone Star ticks, and it's becoming a huge issue in the southeastern United States because it's causing meat allergies. And I immediately eliminated meat out of my diet, and I had gone to Shands, to a doctor that from Shands, and requested an alpha gal enzyme test. And so that alpha gal enzyme test, he argued with me. He'd never heard of it before. And he thought I was being ridiculous about what I was. And I explained to him the symptoms, the elimination diet, that I was having the reaction after going through this elimination diet, that it had to be the meat. And it's red meat specifically. So the alpha-gal test comes back positive. And I said, well, that's interesting. How in the world do we have an enzyme that is now present in a tick that's not ever been present before, and now it's becoming a problem on the southeastern United States? Now, this was back in 2012. And so, and the alpha-gal enzyme can do a couple things too. One, it can be deadly. It can go dormant or disappear, or it can be very mild. I was having, I mean, obviously it wasn't deadly, but I was having severe reactions to it. And eventually it has gone to the point where I can eat red meat at this point. Not a lot, but I can eat a little bit. And I also developed a gastrointestinal issue as well, which I believe, since it came right afterwards, it's probably associated to that enzyme, which I'm not able to digest food very well. It takes a few days for the food digestion to take place. So, and I said, okay, this is just very strange. Well, recently, and you see the big push that's going on out there right now about stopping us from eating meat. Well, the WEF said that they have a way of forcing the world to get off meat. And now you start seeing the alpha-gal enzyme starting to pop up in medical journals and in the news all over the United States presently, as it's becoming a problem that people are having allergic reactions to meat, and the emergency rooms don't know how to diagnose it because they're not even aware of it. And I take it a step further, and I go ahead and I look up the alpha-gal enzyme, and it's patented, which means it's man-made. And so, you know, so we've got, I just find it very interesting that we have entities inside of our government that have been responsible for these things for a very long time. And then it follows through with statements being made by the World Economic Forum that they will force populations off the ability of eating meat, that their bodies will reject it. And then you find that this alpha-gal enzyme is patented. And of course, who knows when it started really infecting the population, but I know it goes back to 2012 when I personally had dealt with it. And so, you know, that just kind of comes full circle, you know. And then I've spoken through a lot to a lot of people throughout the years, and to doctors especially, and other individuals. And of course, there's always an argument. First, it's the paradigm that people can't overcome, that our government would never do that to us. You know, and I kindly remind people that all you have to do is go into the congressional archives and pull up a document from a Senate hearing in 1979, I believe it was, or maybe it was 78, where it was 289 instances of the United States government and military practicing on U.S. citizens. I mean, you had in the 40s where they were injecting plutonium and uranium into orphan children. You have in 2014 alone under the Obama administration, and this made the news, the EPA was spraying chemicals on the elderly in North Carolina to see how they would respond. Then you have bacteria was released on the subway in New York. You have the Tuskegee experiment. I mean, you can go on and on and on about all of the operations that were conducted on U.S. citizens and in the military that are heavily documented in our archives. And when I point this out, you know, a lot of people get very quiet, or they're still argumentative, because it's just a paradigm shift that people cannot get over. And I think we're seeing some changes to that as individuals are learning and understanding of what's coming out of these hearings and all of this new documentation from the studies on a lot of what the issues people are going through in the United States, especially from the most recent vaccines to, you know, what I went through or still going through, you know, from the mid-90s. And, you know, I think people really need to take a different look and do some additional studying on their own to understand really what they're putting in their bodies.
Well, Stephanie, you have covered the the medical aspect, and I so appreciate that. And, you know, here is the question that I will always have, and that is, who could ever trust a government? And or practice experiments on them. Government like that. Your thoughts?
I mean, you know, I think for me, the betrayal was the hardest thing to get over, you know, especially, you know, when we were going through that time period of Benghazi and some of those things happening. You know, my husband had an employee that was in Sigonella and took the phone call for the stand down order. And I remember him saying to me, he was Air Force. He was a young kid. I was shocked for life. This kid talking to him, it scarred him for life. He is not okay. And, you know, he said to me over and over when he told me what he witnessed, he said, the hardest thing I could never understand. It was drilled into us. We never leave a man behind. We never leave them behind. We always get them no matter what. And to sit there and watch that. And I thought about that when I was thinking about what I went through, you know, and I'm thinking, where does this core come from? These core convictions that we have and these oaths that we take. And yet we are the guinea pigs and the subjects to, you know, individuals that are a part of these, you know, deep state complexes or whatever label you want to give it. You know, it was the hardest thing to swallow. And I think for the general public who doesn't have a history of research and dealing with these things and having a personal experience and trying to find out why and what happened and why are there similarities and why are there so many different individuals going through these things, but they're similar at the same time, you know, it's something that's very hard to consume. And I think the average person, I mean, that's, again, I think it goes down to the ultimate betrayal, because if once you believe your government can do that to you, your outlook in the country you live in completely changes and it becomes a little scary for a lot of people. And I think that's where they put that barrier up, where they don't want to believe it, because to believe it means that they're living in a world they could never think that they'd live in.
Well, Stephanie, pardon me. I think my grandfather, who lived to be 100, I think he probably phrased that for me better than anything when I asked him, you know, when he was 97, I believe it was, and I said, Pa, how can a group of people be provided with so much evidence and then they just discard it and go, oh, no, well, that doesn't matter? And I'm talking about hardcore evidence against their own government. How can they just refuse to look at it? And my grandpa told me in his very wonderful Appalachian wisdom mode, boy, ain't nobody wants to believe their mama's a whore, unquote.
That probably nails it right there.
Well, it did for me, because I realized right away that it's not what the truth is. It's what people want to believe. And Stephanie, if I may, I think we talked about this when we were at Sharon's house, but were you aware that all of the Gulf War syndrome records, all of the military files and everything on those vaccines that you took were actually, all of the files were placed in the Mura building in Oklahoma City before the bombing?
Yes, I do remember you telling me that, and I'll add to it. And you know, when you get out, when at the time it was microfiche, you put all your records on microfiche, including your medical records. You get every bit of it copied. Mm-hmm. And when my issue started flaring up again, I had gone to the VA in Orlando, and they lost my record.
So they had no records. Imagine that. I knew it was coming.
So I brought in a second copy. They lost that copy. Now, mind you, in my records, all through it, it has the vaccines, the CFS, everything, that all the studies that they were doing on me while I was in service, all the study groups, the trials, the things that they injected me with were throughout that record. And so the third time that I provided them a record, I finally stopped going. I said, oh, I'm not coming back here. The doctors that I saw wanted to load me up on prescriptions. Some of them were antipsychotic drugs, which I did not need. I was like, I'm not depressed. I have no need for any of these items. And then they also wanted to do spinal surgery on me. And I am not a candidate for spinal surgery, which I thought was very odd as well. And I just said, you know what, I'm not going anymore. And I mean, I won't even visit for prescription. You know, I don't do prescriptions anyway. But if I had to get something minute, I wouldn't even fill it. I have no desire to be anywhere near you know, the VA. And, you know, I have some friends that have worked in the VA, and they've told me some of some inside corruption as well. And it's just, you know, it's shocking, but it's not.
True. You know, I think it was Emma Goldman, and she hit it pretty good about 100 years ago when she said that people do not want to know the truth, and they do not want to be free. They want to be comfortable. And the lies that the government tells them makes them comfortable. And that, to me, is just beyond comprehension, because I see people who reject truth, even when it's presented to them in, you know, hard copy form. They will reject the truth. And, you know, that requires one hell of a psyop. And, you know, yesterday, my friends D.W. Cal and I talked about psyops in America. And I don't think people even realize what's happening. But Stephanie, I kind of, you mind if I throw you a fastball right down the middle?
Sure.
Okay. Who runs this country?
Nobody at the moment.
That's not fair.
I think he's missing in action.
You think he's missing in action, but I mean, truly, when we start talking about the international banking cabal.
Oh, yes.
Who actually controls the country?
Well, the cabal themselves. I mean, you've got the Rothschild family and all associations that have absolute control over, you know, we've got dual citizenship going on. That's a problem. And their alliances to these banking families, you know, they're not for the people at all. I mean, and they're thinking that they're going to subject our military now to additional wars and things that we don't even belong.
Well, I could not agree more. And not to overstep any boundaries here, but what in your military intelligence career taught you that this thing we think we got ain't what we got?
Well, I wasn't in Intel. I was around it, but not, that wasn't my primary. I was on the IT side, so I was exposed to a lot of it. What was your question again?
Well, you know, the point of these people, you know, how do they infect, and how militarily in the intelligence community were you able to pick out any telltale signs of the question I asked you before, who runs the country?
You know, when I was in, I was a little jaded. I was most of my discovery was really afterwards and thinking about those things and what I witnessed. Because one of the biggest psyops, I think, when they were doing Jade Helm, you know, Master of the Human Domain.
2014.
Yeah. So one, but they were working on that well in advance of an actual any kind of rollout. And the psyops on, you know, psychological information against the public was long time coming, and it was ongoing. But really, at the time when I was in, I didn't recognize that, because in my mind, what we were doing was preparing ourselves for an outside entity to be doing that to us, not from it coming from our own government or from the inside. And so my perception on that immediately changed once I started discovering a lot of things about, you know, what happened with my health. And then, of course, I had a paradigm shift very quickly. And then as I started researching and going through archives, you know, everything is out there for us to access. The problem is people don't know where to look, and they don't know that it exists to even go look. And that's the biggest problem with why these psyops, you know, that happen to our own countrymen are so effective, because people don't even have any idea I mean, you just take a look at the subliminal messaging that they have, you know, in on the TV. They flash images so quickly that the human eye cannot see, but the subconscious is able to pick it up, and it embeds it into the subconscious, you know, and it only takes. And one of the biggest things that I used to teach, you know, when, you know, outside of military, you know, when I moved on with my life, You know, I was in sales and I used to teach a sales 101 class. And the biggest thing that I used to teach individuals was how do you commit things to memory is it's based on repetition. You have to say it 5 to 7 times to commit it to the subconscious. And you'll notice when you see people running around that are doing talking points or they have really no foundational information other than what just they hear on the news, you know, it's that same concept, you know, that they run with. And it's, you know, amazing to see. And if you question them on that, that's where that anger, you know, comes from, or they can't dispute it. You know, you see where they call people names. And of course, we just go into that direction. But in addition to one of the other things that I got into when I was doing all of this research was mind control. And I have about 16 years worth of studies on mind control in every government aspect, in addition to how they're using it through even our LED light bulbs by using imagery that, you know, how many times it flashes and the subliminal messages it could plant into your subconscious, cell towers, doing God to skull technology and everything that it's in. And so when people sit there and they laugh or they talk about, you know, I was thinking about this, I didn't even see it. And then Facebook pops up an ad for it. And if they had any idea of the technology that exists, that's open public information. Sometimes it's a little bit harder to find now that they know people are searching for it. And, you know, we talked about this as well. They'll change names of something so you can't find, so that one keyword you may use to look for it, maybe on the CIA website or any other government website, you're not going to find it because they change that keyword term because they know people are going to look for it. And the prime example of that is when Trump was in office, he was calling out Comey in regards to some of the data that was publicized and people were calling him a liar, saying it wasn't there. And then he makes a post, and I think it was on Twitter, where he starts calling him corny. Well, if you go to the CIA website and start looking up what he was talking about by using corny instead of Comey, you'll find all the documentation. Mm-hmm. And so you find that our government does that quite a bit too. Once they realize that even if it's hidden in plain sight, people are starting to catch on, they'll start changing terms to make it harder for people to find.
Well, that is very true. And, you know, I have a great passion for our founding era as well as our so-called Civil War era. And one of my heroes from the founding era is none other than Luther Martin. And folks, if you Luther Martin, of course, is buried in an unmarked grave in New York, and it was paved over for a parking lot. And there is a reason that the people today don't want you to know anything about Luther Martin. So if you go to Google or any other search engine and type in Luther Martin, they will come back with all kind of hits and links to Martin Luther. These are not by mistake. This is not done by mistake. And, you know, one of the things that I've told people over and over again, when they say, well, I've got all of the Anti-Federalist writings, and I say, well, do you have David's writings? Because David wrote from a Christian perspective about the Constitution, and I promise you, you're not going to find his work publicized anywhere in America today, even when they write a book called The Complete Anti-Federalist. It's not there. And I know we're coming up on break time here, guys, but Stephanie, you're doing a fantastic job, lady. Get yourself a little bit of liquid refreshment here, and we'll be back at it on the other side.
You got it.
Come on, Leonard Skinner.
Here's some interesting news. Due to all the recent claims about possible nuclear wars, viruses, solar flares, and civil unrest, people are scrambling to prepare and stockpile food. But the one thing out of reach for many is an underground bunker. Until now. Because you can now have a 3D printed underground bunker in just one day. An excavator digs a hole in your backyard, and 3DBunkers.com shows up in a small truck and sets up their 3D printer under a tent completely undetected. They can print as many rooms as you want at a fraction of the cost compared to traditional metal bunkers. 3D Bunkers uses polymer concrete, which is 5 times stronger than regular cement. YouTube 3DBunkers.com and watch the video. The creators of 3D Bunkers is looking for a business partner that can help bring this technology to the world. And we need to protect our way of life without living in fear. Contact Brad at 3DBunkers.com for more details or visit 3DBunkers.com.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit RepublicBroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.